Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince.
Welcome to the 27th season of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
And we are dealing with some very, very explosive things, such as
bees.
We're going to explain how bees explode, why wasps don't explode, how delicious wasp honey is, before we then climb into a supervolcano, metaphorically.
And then we're going to discover how you might feed yourself inside the supervolcano by eating fungi.
Or ultra-processed food. We're also going to look at ancient DNA and
sharks.
Listen to The Infinite Monkey Cage wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Friday the 9th of June, these are our main stories. Countries around the world are sending emergency crews to help put out wildfires in Canada that are spreading toxic smoke as far south as Florida. Britain and the US announced a new economic deal that falls short of the post-Brexit trade deal the UK had hoped for. Four toddlers severely wounded in a knife attack in France are in stable condition in hospital after undergoing surgery. Also in this podcast, the dramatic moment a humpback whale trapped by a shark net is freed by Australian conservationists. More international firefighters are being sent to Canada to help tackle huge wildfires, which have created a toxic blanket of smoke. The European Union has offered to send nearly 300 fighters to add to the hundreds deployed by the US, as well as those sent by Australia, South Africa and New Zealand. The haze that's drifted across the Canadian border to much of the east coast of the United States has temporarily made some American cities the most polluted on Earth. Poor visibility has led to delay and cancellation of flights into cities along the East Coast, including New York and Philadelphia. These New York residents described their experience.
Right around lunchtime, 1 or 2 o'clock, all of a sudden the entire office really turns yellow and just like deep orange. And I literally cannot see the city past maybe 2 blocks. My entire view had been engulfed in this sort of thick orange cloud of dust everywhere. I could barely even see the people walking on the street.
I first saw the smoke on Tuesday morning. My roommate and I were walking outside and we noticed that the sun was this eerie shade of red, and it got worse and worse throughout the day. A lot of my friends have been saying that their eyes are burning or that they're feeling like they're having headaches. I've never seen New York coated in smoke. The sky is literally orange. It smells like something's burning outside.
They're saying that this is the worst air quality that New York City has had since 9/11 and really never experienced anything before like this in my life.
That's the picture in New York. So what's it like in Washington, D.C.? Our correspondent there is Nomia Iqbal.
Here in D.C., it isn't as scarily orange looking as it is in New York, but there's definitely a haze that's making visibility hard. Just when I was walking into work today, I could barely see the Capitol, the big dome, and there were people wearing lots of masks. I hadn't seen that previously since the pandemic. The air index quality is the key thing here. So it's more than 150 in DC, which is red level, and that's pretty dangerous for everyone. And the mayor here, Muriel Bowser, has been pretty plain terms, you know, what she's saying to residents, that they shouldn't spend any more time than they have to outside in the poor air quality. The White House has had to cancel a Pride event on Saturday. The Washington Nationals have had to cancel their baseball game. But officials are also saying this isn't like COVID. This will pass very quickly.
And the US is sending hundreds of firefighters to help. Other countries are too. Describe the scale of the fires in Canada.
The fires have already burnt more than 9.4 million acres of land. And that's like an area 12 times the 10-year average for this time of year. So really huge. The smoke that's coming over is from more than 430 active wildfires in Canada. So we're talking about, you know, the scale is pretty huge. The Canadian capital is getting hit with some of the worst air quality. Also, the smoke is a serious problem for airlines there. It's created these conditions that's causing more delays than rain or fog. And that's because the airlines there, airlines here as well, they rely on advanced navigation systems on the planes and on the ground. So at the moment, it's still really, really bad in Canada. You mentioned there's more than, you know, 600 US firefighters that have been sent there, and French firefighters have also been deployed.
Noumia Iqbal. Staying with matters Canadian, and a journalist, John Valent, has just published a book called Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World, which studied in particular the 2016 fire in Canada, which drove 90,000 people from their homes. Amazingly, no one died in that fire. But what about the frequency of such fires? Are there more of them, or is it just that the reporting is better and it seems that there are more of them? My colleague, Owen Bennett-Jones, heard more from the author.
I think what we're noticing is fires burning with greater intensity. And certainly this spring in Canada, in the north of North America, there are definitely more fires. So Alberta, which is a very flammable province the size of Texas, has burnt more hectares by this date this year than at any other time in recorded history.
Why is it happening?
There is a steady, incremental but steady drying out of forests, of peatlands, of grasslands, and that is due to the steady rise in temperature that is occurring around the globe. So this is happening in forest systems in both hemispheres, but we're noticing it right now because we're in, you know, summer in the northern hemisphere, and this is the beginning of fire season, but it's off to a truly roaring start because it is drier than ever and warmer than ever.
So I guess the point is that Canada has, you know, previously been, let's say, damp, and it's drying out and there's lots of organic material that can burn, whereas if you go to a desert area elsewhere in the world, it's long been dry, so there's less risk of fire spreading.
Well, in fact, it's all relative. So even in drier areas like New Mexico, South Texas, it's still hotter than it has been historically. And the more you heat something up, the more evaporation is going to happen. You know, leave your pan on the stove or leave your laundry out on the line on a hot, sunny day, it's going to dry fast. And ecosystems really aren't that different.
Author John Valent. Well, as well as the Canadian wildfires, this year has seen many extreme weather events hitting the headlines, including heat waves in Asia and cyclones in Africa. Now scientists have confirmed that the El Niño weather event has begun and that it could lead to further record-breaking temperatures next year and further wildfires and droughts. El Niño occurs naturally every few years and involves warmer water coming to the surface of the Pacific Ocean and releasing heat into the atmosphere. Here's our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
Across the world, the impact of climate change is increasingly evident. As well as wildfires in Canada, there have recently been record temperatures in Europe and Asia, as well as droughts in South America. Now scientists have confirmed another climate phenomenon, called El Niño, will add to this in the coming months. Since March, the seas off the coast of South America have been getting warmer, but that hotter water is now spreading to the centre of the Pacific. This will push heat into the atmosphere, bringing drier weather in Australia, Asia and Africa, and increasing threats of wildfires and drought. The monsoon in India is likely to be weaker. But the big question is about global temperatures. Previous El Niño events in 1997 and 2015 were followed by record warm years. 2024 is expected to be no different. Emily Becker is from the University of Miami and is an expert on El Niño.
What happens during an El Niño is that a lot of heat that's been trapped in the ocean is released to the atmosphere and distributed around the world, particularly if we see a strong El Niño with a really strong warming in the Pacific.
Scientists are worried that the oceans are already experiencing record temperatures. Adding a strong El Niño on top pushes the world into uncharted territory.
Matt McGrath. It was all smiles between US President Joe Biden and the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak as they met at the White House to talk about a whole range of issues, including Ukraine, artificial intelligence and a trade deal, something that those who supported Brexit have long sought. At the news conference afterwards, they announced not a full-blown free trade deal, but an agreement that will strengthen economic ties between the US and the UK. Here's Rishi Sunak.
Today we have agreed the Atlantic Declaration, a new economic partnership for a new age, of a kind that has never been agreed before. Yes, a partnership that protects our citizens, but more than that, a test case for the kind of reimagined alliances President Biden has spoken so eloquently about.
And Mr. Biden gave more details.
It outlines how we can enhance our cooperation to accelerate the clean energy transition that must take place and is taking place, lead the development of emerging technologies that are going to shape so much of our future, and protect technologies critical to our national security.
So what does this all mean for the so-called special relationship between the UK and the US? Here's our Washington correspondent, Jessica Barker.
This is not a free trade deal, as Brexiteers, before the referendum, they talked about it being one of the big aims after leaving the European Union to strike one up with the US. So I think critics are going to read this as a bit of a consolation prize handed to Rishi Sunak. But these types of deals, rather than FTAs, tended to have been favoured by the Biden administration. Biden administration really trying to pursue policies that they say will put American jobs first. But looking at some of the details of this rather grandly named Atlantic Declaration, I mean, it's looking at things like removing barriers affected in the trade of electric vehicle batteries. So some quite significant but specific agreements there, committing the two sides to working on new critical minerals agreements and a new data bridge allowing UK firms to transfer data freely to the US. So I think Rishi Sunak, it gives him something to go home and wave around and say, look, I have genuinely deepened economic cooperation with the United States. But no one can pretend, including him, he's a Brexiteer, Rishi Sunak, that this is anything close to an FTA.
And what else did the two leaders discuss?
Well, so they talked about Ukraine. Obviously, the US is the most significant backer of Ukraine in terms of sending weapons and aid. And Rishi Sunak's message was actually very clear, saying the US was extremely important in this, the decisive contributor. So I think really trying to, from the UK's perspective, talk to the US, where there are voices within Washington who are more doubtful about sending that aid, really trying to relay how significant and important and completely vital it is that the US does keep supporting Ukraine after the Russian invasion. They also talked about AI, artificial intelligence, the UK trying to pitch itself as a central player in this. This summit's going to happen, global summit later this year. I think Rishi Sunak was probably conscious that this subject was being discussed between the EU and the US in a particular forum they have. So Britain trying to make sure that it can muscle in on that. But look, I think overall, Rishi Sunak will be pleased with this visit. Joe Biden said the golden words that no country is closer to us than Great Britain. I think UK diplomats always worry about the special relationship and how it's defined. They'll be breathing a sigh of relief.
Jessica Barker. Staying in the US, and in a surprise move, the Supreme Court has ruled that Alabama violated a law against racial discrimination when it drew up its electoral map 2 years ago. A majority of the justices agreed that the Republican-dominated state had diluted the voting power of black people. Rory Gallimore reports.
More than a quarter of voters in Alabama are black, but there's only one district where they're in a majority. It's also the only area in the state with a Democratic member of Congress. The other six are all Republican. Civil rights groups complained that these boundaries were discriminatory and broke a landmark law called the Voting Rights Act. In a surprise ruling, the Supreme Court, which is dominated by conservative judges, sided with the campaigners. Alabama must now draw up a new map, which includes a second black majority district.
Rory Gallimore. One of the most influential Christian broadcasters in the United States, Pat Robertson, has died. He was 93. An evangelist who helped make religion central to Republican Party politics, Pat Robertson turned a tiny television station in Virginia into a global network. His fiery rhetoric and ruthless pursuit of donations often drew criticism. Our religion reporter, Harry Farley, looks back at his life.
Pat Robertson founded the first Christian TV network in the US, CBN, in 1960.
Welcome, folks. We've got a great program for you today.
For decades, he hosted its popular daily talk show, The 700 Club. The money and platform that brought made him a pivotal player in America's religious right.
I plan to make a formal announcement of my candidacy for the Republican nomination for the presidency of the United States.
In 1988, Robertson ran for the Republican presidential nomination. He came second in the Iowa caucus, ahead of the eventual nominee, George H.W. Bush, thanks to the state's large evangelical community. Although his campaign eventually faltered, it cemented both the importance of conservative Christians in US politics and his own position as Republican Party kingmaker for decades to come. He frequently drew criticism for his outspoken and controversial views.
There's never been a civilization ever in history that has embraced homosexuality and
has survived.
But it wasn't just his on-air comments that drew attention. He was accused of using his charity, Operation Blessing, as a front for his diamond mining business in Africa. And in 2002, he admitted buying a racehorse, despite speaking against gambling. Particularly in later life, he became known for his predictions that often didn't come true.
Romney will win the election.
You believe that?
I absolutely believe
that. What makes you believe that?
Because the Lord told me.
While his prophecies and controversial opinions might be most memorable, Robertson's most enduring legacy will be the alliance he helped to forge in the US between the Republican Party and white evangelical Christians.
Harry Farley. Still to come.
Polished rubies of more than 5 carats are extremely rare, so this stone weighing in at 101 carats uncut was very, very special.
The biggest ruby ever to come up for auction has been sold in New York.
The Explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. As we record this podcast, 4 children aged between 1 and 3 are now in a stable condition in hospital after being severely wounded in a knife attack in Annecy in southeastern France. The children and an adult were operated on by surgeons. A Syrian man is now in custody. The suspect, who'd been granted asylum in Sweden a decade ago, had been recently living in France since separating from his wife and child, who is about the same age as the young victims. Our correspondent, Lucy Williamson, is in Annecy. Some listeners may find the details of her report distressing.
A children's playground, a place of terror. The screams of parents, a glimpse of the horror unfolding as toddlers became the targets of a knife attack. 4 children were stabbed here in quick succession, some in their pushchairs, among them 1 British and 1 Dutch child. The suspect, a Syrian man in his early 30s, was arrested by police outside the playground after stabbing an elderly man. Anthony Latale, a footballer who once played for Liverpool, witnessed the attack.
All of a sudden, a lady said, "Run, run. There's a guy who's stabbing everybody all along the lake. He stabbed some children. Run, run." I told the cops, "Just shoot him. Kill him. He's stabbing everybody."
The local prosecutor in Annecy told journalists there was no apparent terrorist motive. She said the suspect, who had refugee status in Sweden, was unknown to intelligence services and had no known history of psychiatric illness. France's Prime Minister, Elizabeth Borne, expressed the nation's shock.
We are deeply shaken by this odious and indescribable act. When children are involved, people are touched to the core. And today, our whole nation is in shock.
The unanswered question of why toddlers were targeted hangs over France and over the children now silently fighting for their lives.
Lucy Williamson. Ukraine and Russia have accused each other of opening fire on rescuers in the Kherson region, which has been flooded by water pouring out from the breach of the Kakhovka Dam. Ukrainian officials said at least 9 people in Kherson city were injured by Russian shelling. The Russian-backed authorities on the other side of the Dnipro River said 2 people had been killed. The attack came hours after Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky visited Kherson and appealed for international help with the rescue effort. Damien Rance is from the UN children's charity UNICEF.
It's had a significant impact on all the people living along that river strip, 50 kilometres down to Kherson. We're seeing the river level there rise significantly over the last day or so, and many people are still trapped in houses that do need to be rescued.
Thousands of people have been evacuated in dozens of towns and villages. But despite the devastation, many others are choosing to wait until the water subsides, whenever that may be. Our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse has spent the day with a rescue crew in the region.
The task of rescuing people caught up in this disaster has tested Ukraine's resources as it prepares for a major counteroffensive. And today, that task became much more perilous. Russian shells landing in the evacuation zone. While the water levels have stabilised in Kherson, they're still dauntingly high. President Zelensky visited the city centre where he urged other countries to provide more help. Just hours later, Russian missiles struck the square where he was standing.
It's only when you move further down towards the mouth of the Dnipro River, through all of its little tributaries, that you realise the volume of water we're talking about. It's like a strange theme ground ride as we weave through streetlights. And there are people asking for help. Vitaly and Victor here call out for people to see if they want to be evacuated. And so far, no one has taken them up on their offer. They've instead said, our neighbours are elderly, we can't leave them. People have even offered up their pets before themselves.
Many people are stupid, you know. I think it's okay, everything after okay, maybe one day, 2 days, but not okay. Every time water, more.
When these waters finally recede, you wonder what will be left. A partly destroyed city in the heart of one of Ukraine's most fertile farming regions, a surrounding agricultural landscape the size of Norfolk, now at risk of drying up because of irrigation systems being destroyed. This is a war, an invasion by Russia, which takes everything.
James Waterhouse. Well, Ukraine and Russia also continue to trade accusations as to who destroyed the Kakhovka Dam on Tuesday. It's located in an area controlled by the Kremlin's forces. It's far from where much of the most intense fighting is taking place, around the city of Bakhmut in the east. But the southern region is expected to play a key role in Ukraine's long-awaited counter-offensive. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, considers how the dam's destruction could impact Kyiv's plans.
Regardless of exactly who was responsible for breaching the dam, and whether it was by error or by design, the mass flooding that ensued does have an effect on the war in Ukraine. Most immediately, it throws the Ukrainians somewhat off balance, just as they were building up for their main assault on Russian-occupied territory. Dealing with thousands of displaced citizens, their flooded homes and unknown numbers of floating anti-personnel mines is a major distraction. Secondly, it narrows Ukraine's military options in terms of from where they can launch an attack on Russia's positions. Justin Crump is a defence analyst and former British Army officer.
The immediate benefit for Russia of the dam breach is that effectively they've secured 60 miles or so of their front line at the far western end from Ukraine crossing the river and using that as a potential axis against them. So it's given Russia the chance potentially to reorientate its defence with a bit more security. Now, Ukraine will have planned for that, but nonetheless, it is a change in the battlefield that will require adaptation.
Ukraine is good at that. Its forces have shown themselves to be highly flexible and capable of taking the Russians by surprise. But there is no great secret about where their main effort is likely to be directed this summer, in the south, between the city of Zaporizhia and the coast. It's an area where Russia has spent months building up its defences, with deep trenches, minefields and fortified bunkers. Any previous plans by Ukraine, if they had them, to outflank these defences by advancing from the west will now have been thrown into jeopardy by the broken dam and a floodplain that is impassable to tanks.
Frank Gardner. Next to eastern Australia, where a dramatic rescue operation this week to save a humpback whale trapped in a shark net off the country's Gold Coast has reignited the controversy surrounding the protective anti-shark measures. The whale migration season has just begun in Australia, and as Alice Adley reports, there are fears that more of them could become ensnared in the nets.
That was the sound of the 10-metre humpback blowing as it was released from its 12-hour ordeal, trapped in a shark net, a few hundred metres offshore from Mermaid Beach in Queensland earlier this week. The whale was first reported to be trapped on Monday evening, but it wasn't until early on Tuesday morning that rescuers were able to free it from the net, which is designed to stop sharks endangering swimmers. Speaking to Channel 10 First News Queensland, Wayne Phillips, head of marine science at SeaWorld, described the operation.
Well, it was mostly the head stuck
inside the shark control program net, and it had broken off anchor at the southern end of that net. Now, any flick of the tail from an animal that size can really cause some damage, so it's dangerous.
The majority of humpbacks in Australian waters migrate north from June to August and back towards the Southern Ocean from September to November. Around 40,000 are expected to make the journey this year. This man, speaking to Channel 9, said he wasn't sure of the effectiveness of the nets.
I surf here a lot, so I've never seen a shark in all my years of surfing here, so or swimming. If they're doing a good job, I don't know.
This whale wasn't injured, but the pressure group Sea Shepherd say it will have been exhausted from its ordeal, and there's no guarantee it will survive its long journey ahead. Sea Shepherd is calling on the Queensland government to remove the shark nets from the whale's migratory routes. It says 2022 was the worst year on record, with 15 entanglements, and they've taken no action to prevent this from happening again. At least this incident has a happy ending and the whale got to swim away.
That report by Alice Adley. The biggest ruby ever to be auctioned has been sold in New York for a record sum of just under $35 million. The cut stone, which weighed more than 55 carats, was discovered last year in a mine in Mozambique. With more, here's Electra Naismith.
Polished rubies of more than 5 carats are extremely rare, so this stone, weighing in at 101 carats uncut, was very, very special. It heralds from Mozambique, from a mine containing one of the world's largest deposits of rubies. Africa is the new kid on the block in the ruby world. Mozambique, the young upstart in a space previously dominated by Burmese stones. Sotheby's, who auctioned the record-breaking gem, have described it as a once-in-a-lifetime jewel. The same auction saw another record achieved for a pink diamond. The 10.5-carat gem from Botswana, described as a fancy purplish-pink stone, also sold for just under $35 million.
Electra Naismith. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. Before we go, here's Jackie Leonard.
You might have heard the Happy Pod pilots that we ran, and the response was such that we are making it a regular thing. A weekly roundup of the inspiring, uplifting stuff that proves that the world isn't such a dark place after all. The first one will be on June the 10th, and we'd like your input. To start with, the sound of the thing that brings you joy. Email the usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk.
And you can also use that same email if you want to comment on this podcast. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Money laundering operations.
A cyber criminal group.
These are smart guys.
Seasons 1 and 2 of The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service are available in full right now.
Following the twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service. Catch up with the whole series now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.